Jackson, thank you for the job you've done. Revolution is the people's thank you, and the thank yous have just begun. We'd like to thank you, Hank Kissinger. Thank you for the job you've done. Revolution is the people's thank yous, and the thank yous have just begun. Well, you know, you took the power from the people and their land, but now we've got the GI movement, and we'll crush that bloodstained hand.
Hello, Radioland. You're listening to 91.7 WHUS Stores. I'm your host, Graham. This is another episode of Darshiv. And that was People's Thank You to Richard Nixon by the Covered Wagons Musicians from a 1972 Paragon Records release. It's all part of the Alternative Press, I think specifically from the Fred Calabretta collection that we'll get into a little bit more today. And on that topic today, I am chatting with Victoria Johnson, who is a UConn senior, both an English and history double major and a human rights minor. And she's been interning with me this semester to look at materials in the archives and special collections from the Alternative Press, focusing on the anti-Vietnam War movement as far as it pertains to student and GI activism. Victoria, welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
So I was wondering if you could kind of start, I guess, from the beginning and kind of tell us a little bit about your interests in this period, this late 1960s into the mid-70s anti-war movement. What got you interested in that, and how did you go about finding these things in the archives?
Yeah, so I'm really excited to talk about this topic because as a history major and a human rights minor, the history of human rights is kind of like the sweet spot for me. It's one of my very special interests. I particularly am interested in youth protest, which I discovered when I designed a youth protest display for my job at Homer Babbage that was commemorating a 1974 UConn student protest for greater resources dedicated to Black minority students. And the anti-war movement is something particularly interesting to me because it's such a massive protest movement, and it was so visible and defiant of like the highest authority. And I think that that period really demonstrates a historical moment where the American people were deeply conscious of their impact on the human rights of their international neighbors during the war.
And I feel like that, you know, topic, which has been actually pretty prominent here on this campus since it's the 50th anniversary of Woodstock this past year. We did an exhibition at the Archives and Special Collections, Dayglow and Napalm, which was focused on the students of that time coming back as alumni. And we've kind of tried to look at a lot of these different angles. I know generally, you know, the baby boomer population is pretty sort of adamant about discussing that time because I believe similarly, you know, that you think that that was a pretty important time in terms of thinking about student activism. But sort of what else is there to learn about it? Do you feel like we've gotten enough about that generation, or do you think there's still plenty that your generation can sort of draw from them?
I think there's no way that we've talked enough about it. I mean, there's a reason why we still listen to all the protest music from that time period, because it's not just like an isolated instance. It's like a historical trend of organizing and protest to make sure that people's voices get heard when people don't agree with what, you know, the larger institutions that they belong to or doing, like a government or like a university.
And so how did you go about finding, research topics on this? I know you could have done anything within the war in Vietnam. How did you land specifically on this element of GI activism and student activism?
Yeah, so I wasn't sure what I was looking for in the archives at first to start this project, but I began to get a clearer picture when I started focusing on audio and visual resources, specifically looking at things that were dealing with students who, you know, I can relate to. And Diary of a Student Revolution really helped me narrow my topic in that way by giving me the context of the period within, like, the geographical space of UConn itself. And from that resource, I got to learn, like, what exactly was motivating student protesters in that specific instance of protest. And from there, I wanted to see more examples of students protesting, but also other youth who weren't in college, youth who were also in the Army, too.
And so what, what sort of media were the students themselves engaged in? You know, you'd mentioned Diary of a Student Revolution, which is a film documentary, more or less, done by a pretty adept film crew. It's, you know, a really great angle of both the sort of administration side and the student side, which we've featured on this program before, and we'll play a quick clip from here in a few minutes. But what other kind of media were the students themselves generating at that time?
Well, in my internship working with the Fred Calabretta Collection, which was a collection of 1960s memorabilia, I got to see a lot of kind of just the everyday things that people had at the time that expressed their political opinions, like decorative posters and LPs that were protest music and things like that, popular magazines. Yeah.
Good. Let's take a quick dip into the 1969 film about the University of Connecticut, and this is Diary of a Student Revolution.
University campuses are in turmoil over issues ranging from black studies to on-campus recruiting. This is the diary of such a campus, once called Fun Farm by its president. But Fun Farm suddenly erupted in the fall of 1968 when a group of students and faculty demonstrated against on-campus recruitment by the Dow Chemical Company, whose most famous products are Saran Wrap and napalm. This was followed in November by the occupation of the university's executive building, including the president's office. At the end of the month, there was another confrontation with a badgeless contingent of the Connecticut State Police during a protest against recruiting by the Olin Matheson Corporation. There were 21 arrests, at least 4 injuries.
So that seemed like a pretty good setup to kind of describing what was happening here at UConn. What did you find powerful about that clip?
Well, what I like about that clip is that it specifically tells you exactly what the students were concerned about. They weren't just protesting, you know, the fact that the country was at war. They were specifically protesting how they felt the university had made them complicit in the war and in the human rights crimes being committed in Vietnam, which the Dow Chemical Company was enabling by producing napalm. And an important party in the protests was SDS, Students for a Democratic Society. And they really saw that UConn's allowance of Dow Chemical Company's presence on campus to be indirect support of the war and therefore just completely intolerable.
We also featured a few of the SDS members who had gone to school here in a previous episode. And it was really instructive just to kind of hear like how committed they were to that kind of activism, and that they were very much willing to put their bodies up, you know, in exchange for maybe getting arrested, just as long as, you know, Ellie Goldstein, actually, one of the women who I interviewed, you know, she was very proud to have been one of maybe 2 women that got arrested on one of the larger days of student protest at 7 Gilbert Road. And for her, this was, you know, something to be very proud of, right? She was happy to have been one of those people. And it makes me kind of, I guess, wonder more about students your age. And I kind of wanted to ask more broadly kind of about the, you know, how protest movements from the 60s, how do those compare to ones today? You know, are there students like yourself who would be, you know, proud to like put university education on hold in exchange for, you know, having some political action go forward? How do you think these two things kind of relate, like the period that you're looking at and today? What's different? What's similar?
Yeah, I think the sentiment, you know, throw your body upon the wheels is still something that rings true for a lot of people. I think looking at even just this semester, the climate of student protest, at least so far in my UConn career, it has been a much stronger presence this semester than ever before. And I think, you know, the committed radicalism of the 1960s, you know, it catches a lot of attention. It was really visible because of the protests. But as we see in the end of Diary of a Student Revolution, after winter break, those protests kind of dwindled out, and they really suffered after that point. But I think the climate today, there's a lot more sustained enthusiasm for the different social and climate justice causes that people are concerned about. And I think the reason for that is because of the rise of collaborative organized protests at UConn amongst different organizations like Fridays for Future, UConn Collaborative Organizing, the NAACP UConn chapter, and more. The fact that they're working together now, it really contributes to the strength of each individual movement. And I think this is the biggest change between the protests of the 1960s and now, is that there is unity between a bunch of diverse student groups under the same banners.
And I think that's been a critique for, you know, many decades now about how there's too many issues, you know, and like obviously that feels a lot more like an attempt to sort of disarm a lot of the rigor of student organizing and just general activism, because, you know, gosh, you can't be too complicated of a person and have too many concerns about
right.
What's going on. Doesn't that kind of say like there's actually too much to be worried about? Well, whose problem is that? So instead of a splinter, it feels kind of what you're saying, more of a cohesion that's bringing folks together around kind of these solidarity banners. And so to that effect, I guess I'm wondering also about the element of the GIs. You know, this is an element that I don't believe I have seen much in our collection. I know there is some because clearly you've sort of begun researching it. There's a clip that I want to play that you have chosen from one of the LPs. And yeah, I hope I can hear a little bit more about how you got on to the issues of GIs. Let's listen to Napalm Sticks to Kids by Covered Wagon Musicians.
We shoot the sick, the young, the lame. We do our best to kill and maim, because the kills all count the same. Napalm sticks to kids. They're in good shape for the shape they're in, but God, I wonder how they can win with napalm running down their skin. Napalm sticks to kids. CIA with guns for hire, Montagnards around the fire. Napalm makes the fire higher. Napalm sticks to kids. A baby sucking on his mother's t- children cowering in a pit. Dow Chemical doesn't give a shit. Napalm sticks to kids. Teen kids in a no-fire zone, books on their arm as they go home. Last in line goes home alone. Napalm sticks to kids.
That was, again, Covered Wagon Musicians from the 1972 Paradon Records release, We Say No to Your War. Wow, yeah, that was a heavy song. It sounds like, I don't know, it's got the same sound that you would imagine a very popular protest kind of song would have, but yet I have never heard that or anything about that in any kind of mainstream or otherwise from that same period. What about that song spoke to you?
So just to give a little background on the Covered Wagon musicians and this album, this was the most unexpected and my personal favorite discovery in my research in the archives this semester. And when I first heard it, I knew that I had to broaden my topic about student protests to include the GI movement as well, because everything on this album was sung and spoken and produced by active or veteran GIs. And the Covered Wagon was an organization that was anti-war even while they were, you know, currently enlisted, and they faced a lot of, you know, difficulties in Mountain Home, Idaho, where the Air Force base was, where they were located. There's a pamphlet included in the archives with this album, and the insert describes kind of the impetus of the group's creation and their mission statement. And it says, "It is the story of men and women who have, by working with others, liberated themselves from the diseases of war, hatred, ignorance, racism, and injustice, diseases that abound in epidemic proportions in our acquisitive society." So I thought that when I heard this, it just really opened my mind to the fact, like, youth protest was not exclusive to college students, that there were all kinds of youths who had opinions about the war that deserved to be expressed, which is why the Covered Wagon organization created this album to help GIs who, you know, were devastated by their own participation in the war, help them talk about it in a productive way.
Yeah, I think that's very cool, especially in terms of the sort of average media piece that we have in the archives. From the GI perspective, typically it is like the newspaper produced by the cavalry unit or the Stars and Stripes issue or something that is more or less meant to boost the morale and kind of give some home front, you know, reassurance, I guess. Whereas this is very different from that, right? This is an outlet that GIs can use to ostensibly describe the negative aspects of what they're involved in. And also that this is a 1972 release means that some of these guys could have been drafted. So you have that sentiment about, okay, you know, you're trying to think through how are GIs against the war that they've maybe enlisted in, but they could very well be drafted into this position.
Yeah, and to speak to Napalm Sticks to Kids specifically, which is my favorite song from the album, it was a poem written collaboratively by a group of Air Force and Army GIs from the 1st Air Cavalry while they were on duty in Vietnam. And according to the album insert, it was based on their real experiences. So upon returning to Mountain Home in Idaho, the Air Force base, Sergeant Mike Elliott saw that the poem was published in the very first volume of the Covered Wagon's alternative press newspaper called The Helping Hand. And the voice that recites the GI's words is Sergeant John Boychuk, who was a Vietnam veteran of the Air Force.
Did we have The Helping Hand in the collection?
We did not, and as far as I know, it is impossible to find.
Okay. Yeah, I'm going to have to keep my eyes out for that. I'll have to ask Fred if he's seen any of those in case I get another donation from him. But yeah, that would be a great little addition there. Because again, other newspapers typically are not from the sort of dissenting GI perspective. So, but it also makes me think a lot about this kind of trend of well-known periods of GI resistance through things like the Winter Soldier, the Vietnam vet against the war, which we also had the Iraq veterans against the war. And there's a lot of sort of, you know, poetry involved in their reconciliation with the things that they've done. How, I guess, did the activism itself really differ? Because I know, like, thinking about GIs, they're under the sort of scrupulous control of how the Army operates, whereas students, you know, are on college campuses. They're definitely not in the same sort of, you know, militaristic style of organization where if you resist, you could be held for treason or mm-hmm. something here on a university campus. But how did the activism between the GIs and students on campus compare? How were they different? What were the similarities?
Yeah, so just to give a few more details about the covered wagon, they also, you know, had protest marches and things like that. They actually marched through the desert at one point, like from one town to another, I think. Their coffee house where they would meet as their headquarters was burned down by unknown arsonists. So they met, I would say, a significantly increased amount of opposition compared to the students, even though the students were arrested. I wanted to show this song, Napalm Sticks to Kids in particular, because it shares one super, super important thing in common with the Yukon protests from 1968, which is the very specific criticism of Dow Chemical Company for the production of napalm. So both of these very different situations and protests emphasize the moral dilemma that many people in the United States had considered with the use of napalm as a weapon for war and the way it had, you know, great, great potential to grievously harm or kill non-combatants. And, you know, it does seem like there is a little bit more privilege in the way the students get to protest because they seem to feel a little bit safer within their own community, within a university system that they still subscribe to speak their minds, as opposed to the GIs who are part of a system, the Army, that they explicitly did not want to be a part of. And the insert of the album that I mentioned a few times also says a lot of the personal experiences of some of the members, and over I saw that they were applying to be conscientious objectors. And it takes a lot of time to do that, but that was the goal of everyone in the movement.
Right. I remember hearing a lot of alumni when they came back for the exhibition that we did say, you know, whenever we'd bring up the question about like how did other students kind of get brought into the fold of protesting against the war in Vietnam, how does that compare to students today? And the number one thing that they all said was, well, we were drafted. You know, like if there was a draft today, how many more students would feel either at risk for going into a war that they, you know, maybe didn't agree with or just didn't see the sort of need for it from a sort of international perspective. But that one major impetus seems to be a pretty strong driver between these two different kinds of protest movements, but still similarly, they're situating themselves against what ultimately was a war that, you know, didn't really come out well for the United States and absolutely did not come out well for the people of Vietnam. So do you want to transition now to Kent State?
Yeah, that sounds great.
Okay, so I believe you selected a clip from an album by Pete Hamill titled Murder at Kent State University. This is The Army of the Young.
It is Sunday now, and the Army of the Young is gone. A bright sun is playing on the monuments and the parks. The walls of buses have been removed from the White House. No jeeps rumble through the streets in convoys as they did through the night. There is still a taste of tear gas in the air, but the weekend is now over. The Army of the Young has gone home, taking with it its style, energy, sweetness, outrage, and courage. It might never come back, except in triumph. They came streaming into town early on Friday, and by Saturday, there were thousands of them. Legions from Kent State, students with t-shirts from Cornell and UCLA and Princeton, tough street kids from Brooklyn, girls with gleaming faces, boys with blonde mustaches and cowboy clothes, short-haired boys from the University of Virginia, wearing white medical smocks. They were the Army of the Young, invading the privileged sanctuaries of the country of the old.
I love that narration mixed on top of that sort of heavy bass line. It just gives you this sort of grim feel about sort of a morning after, you know, and kind of testing out the energy that was there. Can you briefly explain a little bit about that clip? What drew you to it? What about youth protest, I guess?
Yeah, so this album, Murder at Kent State University, was put together by the journalist Pete Hamill, and it's a nonfiction piece about the murder at Kent State. What's really amazing about it is that it was published within the same year, like only months later after the tragedy. So you can only imagine the incredible impact this would have had on someone listening to it at that time. And I really liked this section of it, this narration, because it embodies the enormity of protest culture in the United States as youth, protest culture as representing youth culture in the army of the young. Within the context of the Kent State University, the image of the youth of the United States rising up in defiance against the highest authority as a quote-unquote army is even more meaningful for this reason. And I just think it demonstrates really the power of popular media to influence people and to show like the power of people in a historical sense. Because while this event is something that we'll always remember in history, this album made only months after was acknowledging already that it was history and it was historically significant.
That's an interesting element, just kind of the presence, having the presence of mind of thinking through that this is an important moment as far as colleges are concerned, as far as this war is concerned, the role of the National Guard. And I think, in terms of memorialization, Kent State is always one of those first things that jumps out as we've gone too far. You know, like all of a sudden this war is now about something completely different. And in a way that kind of speaks to the successes, I think, of the activism that students engaged in, right? To kind of draw it to that level. Unfortunately, four kids had to get shot in order to do it that direction, but not to mention the other ones that were shot in the South at the other university. But yes, that seems to be an element of this. And so I guess that element of the media, how does this sort of record, this LP, how does it kind of start to become self-generating? Like, at what point did you encounter other forms of media that were reproducing some of these narratives, that were kind of retelling these same tales? Did you hear a lot about Kent State in the GI-related activism that you found?
I didn't hear a lot about Kent State in the GI activism. In the other materials in the Calabretta collection, there was a lot of stuff about like president speeches and things like that, but as far as the actual protest content, like a good percentage of it was about Kent State as well. There's also a book about it, I think. And I think one of the main reasons why this particular album stuck out to me was because it was published so soon after. And if I've learned anything being an intern in the UConn Archives and Special Collections, it's that the archives perform a critical role in the preservation of the history of human rights. So materials like this album teach us not only, you know, just the history of like human rights and activism and the abuse of human rights, but also, you know, how people viewed it in that historical moment and how they were conscious of the fact that this was something that would go down in history.
Right. Yeah, that presence of the period itself is always worth reflecting on. And I feel like the alternative press just has a broader collection. I know you listen to a lot of different albums within the Fred Calabretta collection itself, and then some elements of student newspapers that kind of came along as well. To what extent do you find that kind of media to be something that today you would consider as a student to be reproducible? Like, do you see students like yourself ever wanting to go back to a printed form that's going to be able to get the information circulated in a physical sense? Or sort of has digital kind of gone the direction that you would see being the most impactful?
I think digital really has taken a huge role in the environment of student activism. Like, if you're not part of the Facebook group for Fridays for Future or following the Instagram or someone you know isn't doing those things, then it's going to be hard to know, you know, when to assemble, when to organize. And in some ways, it is more helpful because it's so accessible. You don't need to go buy it or find someone who has that hard copy for you. But yeah, I think about word of mouth a lot.
Which makes it all the more difficult for the archivist to bring that stuff in because it's so, on the point and at the moment.
And I think the visibility of human rights injustices is something that is so important when you have the hope of actually engineering change. Regardless of whether a protester from the late 1960s or early 70s were students or GIs, their goal was always to increase the visibility of that argument and of the human rights that they saw were being abused, whether that means creating an anti-war music album or marching to Gully Hall at UConn. And as a human rights student and, you know, an aspiring activist, I hope I could say that, to see the way in which Archives continues that conversation of justice from the past into the present, it gives one, you know, hope for the future that this is something and these are moments that people aren't just going to forget about. And ultimately, you know, the mission of Archives to preserve these memories and artifacts serves to continue that visibility far past, like, the immediate future of what we foresee into, you know, a future where patrons will see what we've tried to accomplish now.
Yeah, I think that's an appropriate reflection and sort of important in and of itself, because I believe that the people who were involved in this period, you know, they still talk about it enough to where this was a very emblematic moment of what their generation was going to be about. How is it going to differ from the one before? How is it different from your generation here on this campus? And I'm sure they're always curious to just kind of see what are the back and forth, what are the dialectics about, you know, how successful will your generation be by replicating the movement that they were involved in? You know, will it ever be the same? What can they sort of teach you, but what should you turn away from, you know, at the same time? But yeah, I think that's an appropriate way of looking at certainly the historical reflection for sure. So can you tell us a little bit about what other materials you looked at? I know you'd mentioned some of the things from the Fred Calabretta collection, but then there was a couple of other LPs I know you'd talked about. We almost had more audio material to play from than we could, but what other things did you find interesting?
Yeah, so just to start with the Calabretta collection, it was expansive. And the types of materials that were there. There were, like I said earlier, decorative posters, anti-war and political posters. There was one bound, oversized book that was just enormous, that every page was a poster, but it was telling, a satirical story about Richard Nixon. There were endless LPs, which included audio documentaries that were about the 60s in general as a decade, Vietnam, the draft, protests. There were a lot of LPs specifically about the lives of presidents or talking about specific speeches that were recorded. And then there were, you know, just things that people engaged with at the time in popular media, like Rolling Stone and other popular magazines, magazines targeted at teenagers specifically. And then a couple books that reflected on the culture and the events of the 60s.
Yeah, that element of the ephemeral, which I think makes up a good portion of this collection. And it's an easy, loose word for archivists to kind of float around a lot, because what isn't ephemeral really that gets kind of passed around day to day? But the buttons that they wore a lot, patches, things that, you know, sort of made up the costume more or less of what the protest was or the protester was to wear as they went in and engaged in those political issues, become just as emblematic. I know that aesthetically, a lot of folks draw from, you know, previous generations and how they adorn themselves. So just the look a lot has a strong impact from how that collection was really produced. But I'm glad you got good use out of it, because I think the audio side of things, it takes time to kind of go through and sit down and record and think through what is the importance of a underground sort of published audio piece versus, you know, a speech by Richard Nixon, you know, mm-hmm. that can be very dry, but very important. Let's boil it down to a sound bite. I think you did that very well. Well, again, you've been listening to Darshiv. I was joined today with Victoria Johnson, who is a human rights minor and an English and history major here at UConn and will be graduating this year. And she also managed to intern as well at the Archives and Special Collections this semester. And I think you've done a great job in sort of summarizing and getting the energy from this period and have hopefully learned a lot about just getting into what a collection like this can really do for thinking about other ways of activism, and you've demonstrated that today. Any other final thoughts, Victoria, about this topic or about things you experienced at the archives?
Just that, you know, if anybody has any interest in looking at the archives collections, please just come and ask, because it's for everybody. One of my friends once asked me if she was allowed to go inside because she's not a grad student. So it's an open space for everybody. And if you're interested in the GI movement, there's also, you know, a lot of materials from other decades as well, like the Cal Robertson papers. And he was a GI who was against the war. He was in the Navy during the Vietnam War. And he was arrested many times for civil disobedience and activism on Army bases throughout the 80s and 90s. So there's tons of stuff to check out.
That's great. Thanks for that plug. All right. Well, that's it. And we will check everybody else next week. You've been listening to another episode of Darshiv on 91.7 WHUS Stores. You can find out more about the UConn Archives and Special Collections at UConn Archives on Twitter and Facebook. Subscribe on iTunes or listen online at whus.org. Our theme song is Dream in Casio Tone by Arable Lands, graphic design by Melika Bloom. I'm your host, Graham Stinnett. Thanks for listening, and we'll catch you next time.